Agape Stories, where you get to know your church and stories that matter for the church.
Welcome back to Agape Stories, a podcast where we seek to share stories within the Agape Chicago community. I am Craig, and with me today is...
Grant.
Yes, back again.
Back for more.
History. Grant has been tasked with sharing about a historical figure, and today, who are we going to look at?
Fannie Lou Hamer.
And before we do, we wanted to do just a little icebreaker where Grant and I share a little about our stories, one little piece, and we want to share about the first job that we both had. So, Grant?
My first job, I was a sandwich artist. That's what my name tag said. And my apron, too, said sandwich artist. Those are the people who make your sandwiches at Subway.
So. That's amazing. I was a recycling artist. I worked at a scrapyard in Michigan and sorted through a bunch of different metal. So... somewhat related and unrelated to our person today, but just wanted to jump off with a little fun facts. And so we said her name, but give just a little brief snippet on who we're looking at today, Grant.
So Fannie Lou Hamer was a sharecropper, which is why we started off with the jobs. Fannie Lou was a sharecropper. She was actually the 20th daughter of sharecroppers. So
wow. Yeah. Fruitful and multiply.
Indeed. And if you know anything about slavery and the history of slavery, post-slavery, sharecropping was basically slavery by another name. So She was born into a family of sharecroppers, descendant of slaves. She was born in 1917, and she was born in Mississippi. She was a voting rights activist, and she was a powerhouse. She was a very, very special woman.
That's great. Well, we're excited. I'm excited to hear a little bit more about her. She's not one that I know tons, but can you just give us more about her beginnings and things that were influential in her early life?
Right. So 1917, she dies in 1977. So we're looking at Jim Crow era Mississippi.
Okay.
Mississippi at this time has the highest rate of lynching in America. So that's an important kind of background for the climate of racial violence that's there, impunity that's there for vigilante justice, so justice without actual law enforcement, or sometimes even law enforcement doing the lynching. She only had up to an eighth grade education, but she really flourished under the guidance of Black teachers. As you can imagine, in this backdrop of racial violence, discrimination, her educational opportunities were not great, but she had some really great Black teachers who helped her.
Was that in a school setting?
Yeah, it was in a school setting, but her county only had a school up to eighth grade. As a sharecropper, you're expected to help your family. You are your two hands making money for your family, right? So her educational opportunities were limited, but she really took advantage of them. Her parents really encouraged storytelling. So Fannie Lou Hamer was a big time orator. We're going to get to that in a little bit, but her dad was also a part-time minister. So she's in this environment where storytelling, preaching, she's formed in that. And her parents also gave her really biblical upbringing too, despite the oppression that they faced. Her parents, in the words of a biographer, and the biographer that I'm using is Kate Clifford Larson. The book she wrote is Walk With Me, a biography of Fannie Lou Hamer. That's kind of our source material for the day.
Okay. Walk With Me.
Walk With Me, which is a Negro spiritual we'll talk about a little later on. Larson talks about how Hamer's parents taught their children to trust in God's will and not hate anybody, in spite of the relentless racism and discrimination that they faced every day. And this is Fannie Lou Hamer's words. It might not matter what you do to me, Hamer later told an interviewer, but it makes a whole lot of difference to my insides what I do to you. If I hate you, then we're just two miserable people. Hate is something destructive.
That's a powerful quote. One to that speaks, very poignantly to our own time, one to really meditate on. So I think even within her home, you can kind of see some of advocacy starting to grow. But what kind of is her start within advocacy outside of her home setting.
Right. So I mentioned at the beginning, she was a voting rights activist, but her initial formative events that pushed her to advocate were actually not necessarily related to voting. She had obviously the racial climate and discrimination she faced daily, pretty significant and formative. But one big event she had was she actually suffered a forced hysterectomy. Ugh. So without her consent, she suffered from some abdominal pain, and the family that they sharecropped for, her and her husband, she told them about it and they recommended it to the doctor. Mm-hmm. She went in for a procedure and then came out, and she actually, even after coming out, did not know that the hysterectomy was performed on her.
Wow.
And she overheard a cook, I believe it was, the cook on the Marlow plantation overheard Vera Alice, another person on the plantation, discussing Hamer's surgery, and she alerted Hamer. Basically, the doctor did this to you, and you had no idea.
Oh, man.
Hamer was devastated. She had a very strong dream and longing to have children. To find out that a doctor did that to her was incredibly traumatic. And this is actually a pretty common practice, not just in Mississippi, but throughout the United States at this time. We can talk more about that maybe later, but
sure.
Hamer referred to this as her Mississippi appendectomy, is what she called it.
Okay.
This, as you can imagine, creates a lot of anger. And to quote Larson, she says, robbed of her fertility, Hamer could no longer contain her rage, but the experience transformed her. Her fury fueled her long simmering passion for change. No longer satisfied to just exist, she vowed never to be voiceless or silenced again. Her political invisibility was about to come to an end.
That's kind of, as we wrapped up our series in Genesis not too long ago, right at the end is that famous verse of what they meant for evil, God can use for good, or meant for good. And still, even through this, she uses it to empower herself.
Yeah, there's a gospel song I really love called He Turned It by Ty Tribbett.
He
quotes that line, and he specifically says, what hell meant for evil, God turned it around for my good. The whole song is about God turning it from what hell meant for evil, God will turn to good.
Yeah. Well, I guess let's talk about some of the good, or how that evil was
transformed.
Yeah. In her work as an advocate.
So she has this backdrop of discrimination toward her, forced hysterectomy. She's been very silenced in that. At the same time, so this is 1960s, a friend of hers, there's lots of Northern volunteers that are kind of descending on the South in these voting rights registration efforts. And so a friend invites her to a meeting, and as she actually tries to get her to host the meeting in Fannie Lou Hamer's house. Mm. She does. And at this meeting, she just gets new life. It's like, wow, what's going on here? So this is Hamer's words reflecting on the meeting. She said, 90% of the Negro people in Mississippi have gone to church all their lives. They have lived with the hope if they kept standing up in a Christian manner, things would change, Hamer later told friends. During the meeting, she caught a glimpse of what was possible. The seeds for liberation those young people were offering took root in her soul. It's another quote from Hamer. Just listening at them, I could see myself voting people out of office. And I know I was wrong and didn't do nothing to help the poor.
Mm.
So a few days later, that meeting happened, I believe, late August of 1962. On August 31st, she goes down straight to the courthouse with some fellow people from her community to register to vote.
Mm.
Hamer was dressed in her Sunday best.
Hey.
And packed a small bag to take with her. She was she said she had, quote, a feeling she might get arrested. So she carried her change of clothing just to be ready. She also had a pair of comfortable shoes. So she was prepared. Her quote here is really interesting, though. She says, I guess if I'd had any sense, I'd have been a little scared. But the only thing they could do to me was kill me.
Yeah.
And it seemed like they've been trying to do that a little bit ever since I could remember. She was the first off the bus. People who were there recall that she's a beeline straight for the courthouse. And after spending several hours at the courthouse, they try to register. And as they're heading back home, a police car pulls them over. The highway patrol car said that their driver was driving a bus, quote, the wrong color. It was a yellow bus. It was a yellow school bus. So it gives you an idea of this sort of arbitrary policing that was happening.
Right.
Everyone on the bus is shaken with fear. They took the driver back to town and put him in jail for taking this group of black people to register to vote. And basically what had happened is that the Citizens Council, which was a white supremacy group, they were on top of this. The second any black person would go to vote, they would call the authorities. And in Hamer's case, actually, they called the sharecropping family that owned the plantation where Hamer and her husband worked. And that the family's name was Marlowe. So Mr. Marlowe, he told Fannie Lou's husband that she needed to withdraw her name from potential registration immediately. And then when Hamer got there, he said that to her. Hamer's exact words to him were, "Mr. Marlowe, I didn't go to Indianola to register for you. I went to register for myself."
Tell him.
But that comes at a consequence for her.
Right.
She basically is kicked off the plantation.
Mm.
And there was retaliation for this group as well. So on the night of September 10th, so she goes to register August 31st with a small group. Night of September 10th, Knight Riders or Klansmen, otherwise known as white terrorists, they drove through shooting at homes of local blacks who had hosted civil rights workers who had tried to register to vote. Hamer at this time is basically couch surfing with friends and relatives who will let her stay there. Her husband continued to work at the plantation.
Okay.
And one of the things that is interesting here is Hamer's own reflections on this time. And Hamer remembers imploring God, quote, "Give me a chance. Just let me do something." So she thought about the young people who came down from far away, students who were trying to register others to vote, and who were risking their lives for her and her neighbors, their civil rights. And she realized God had already answered her. Mm-hmm. She says, "The new kingdom was right here on earth." When she looked at those young people, she said, "I'd choose these young people who had given them all the hope that they'd prayed for all those years."
Hmm. I think in any kind of movements like that, to be able to have leaders is so important, people to, for the youth to be able to look up to. And with the dates, it's hard not to think of her contemporaries with Martin Luther King Jr. But let's just, kind of focus on her emergence as a leader,
right,
for a little bit.
So the main leaders here, this is the people she's working with, are SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Commission, SNCC, which are mostly student activists in the 60s, and they worked a lot with Southern Christian Leadership Conference, all NAACP, all these organizations we've probably heard of. SNCC was sort of the student, they weren't exclusively students, but it was mostly students, and it was very voting heavy, at least at this time. She is not a student. This is
right,
1960s. She was born in 1917, like I said. So, you know, she's mid 40s, right? I do my math right.
I think that's 50s, yeah. Well, hold on. Whatever. Yeah, because 20. Yeah,
mid 40s. Okay. Yep. So, mid 40s. She's not a student, but the students recognize her immediately as a leader, which is really interesting. It's just this interesting image of, you know, a bunch of 20 somethings, and then here's this middle aged woman who they revere, they absolutely admire, just like crazy. And part of that is Hamer has this super special presence. She had an ability to interweave song and preaching in ways that were just electric. This is a quote from the biography. It says, "She was more than twice as old as many of the SNCC workers and activists. Some of them felt that they were, quote, in the presence of a moral force." For her part, Hamer believed that young people showed, quote, "more Christianity than I've ever seen in a church."
Wow.
One college student recalled riding the bus with Hamer to a workshop, said, quote, "Hamer was the star, the person that all of them were wowed by. No one equaled her storytelling. She testified, preached, led them in rousing freedom songs, and was the center of attraction. Whenever Hamer got up to speak, the room hushed. She was a powerhouse. She would shine her light in these workshops. People got caught this spirit." And there's actually the Smithsonian has on Spotify. You can go look at it, listen to it yourself. It's called Songs My Mother Taught Me. And it's a whole album of Fannie Lou Hamer. It's a mix of her speeches and songs. Mm-hmm. And you can go listen to it. I mean, she has a very, very special voice. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, she was a SNCC activist at the time, went on to be a congresswoman. She thought that only Martin Luther King Jr. rivaled Hamer's oratorial skills, and she said, and her extraordinary brilliance. Hamer had the capacity to put together, quote, a mosaic of coherent thought about freedom and justice. Norton remembered that, quote, her speeches had themes, they had lessons, they had principles. Hamer gave those speeches in ringing style. You never needed to hear anybody else speak again. So Hamer starts to emerge as his voice, and it's someone that will lead these young people, and also someone whenever they have public events, they want Hamer up in the front.
They're drawn to her. They want her to be there. I know we'll speak a little bit more in a little bit about her as a leader and preacher and whatnot, but let's spend a little time talking about the cost of this advocacy.
Right.
And yeah, because obviously to be in this role at this time, she's counting the cost.
Right. So we talked about at the beginning, the backdrop of the most extreme form of racial violence at this time, which is lynching, in Mississippi being the capital of lynching. But there were all sorts of different tactics that local authorities would use to discourage them from voting. And it makes you think about the power of a vote. And we live in a democratic country, right?
Totally.
Think about how much power there is in a vote, that people go to these great lengths to stop people just from registering. So to give an idea here, I'm going to focus on one specific event of Hamer's advocacy. So they were known for the voting rights work they were doing. After a workshop, they went on a bus and they were, I think, returning home, but they were testing the segregation of bus terminals, which weren't supposed to be segregated at this time. So a few activists get off the bus. They're in Winona, Mississippi. They get off the bus. They're kind of testing whether or not this, I think it was kind of like a sandwich shop, would allow them as Black customers.
Sandwich artists?
Oh, gosh. they were testing whether or not they would let them get a sandwich or whatever it was that they were looking for. And Winona had a massive history of discrimination and racial abuse within their police department. At this time, the Department of Justice had actually investigated their police officers for alleged abuses numerous times in the late 1950s and early 1960s. But witness tampering and evidence destruction by the local authorities basically made those efforts completely null. So gives you an idea of the extent of the problem that the Department of Justice was investigating, but also the lengths they were willing to go to cover that out of the literature. So that's the context here in Winona. Be my friend.